Okay, so I just had a discussion with Mark about this yesterday. So I'll just say one exponential family. So this is a very standard thing in statistics, theoretical statistics that people consider while modeling. So just consider simple graphs that is undirected without loops, self-loops on n vertices. And suppose you have t1 to tk are features of interest in the graph. So maybe t1 is the number of triangles, t2 is the number of t1 is the number of edges, t2 is the number of triangles, etc. So what statisticians do in this case is the null model that they define is, okay, you have an exponential family, so you have a probability measure of this form. You take a linear combination of these sufficient statistics. So these are called the sufficient statistics. So what this means is that in some sense, all the information about these unknown parameters, so these are the unknown parameters that you have to estimate from the data, are contained in these sufficient statistics. So this has to be estimated from the data, and this is the log of the normalizing constant. So in physics, you have like Z inverse, and in statistics, people write this as in the exponent. And the data is a single realization of the graph. So you just have one realization. And there isn't much work about these kinds of models, at least in the rigorous mathematical sense, because, or even in physics, there isn't much work because it's hard to handle these, for almost anything that you can think of, how to handle these objects. So here's some literature. It's a very sparse literature. So it was in yes.
Yeah, but
you can
go back and explain
this a little
bit more.
Okay, so you have a random graph. Your data is a single realization of the graph.
What distribution?
What?
Random with respect to what distribution?
Yes, so this is the distribution. That's what I'm saying. So
off graphs.
Off graphs.
You assume that there is some beta I which you don't know.
Yes.
And your random graph is given to you with respect to that distribution.
Yes. Yes.
So you're trying to figure out. Like if you sample edges, triangles, etc., and say, well, it came from some distribution, then what are the betas that would have produced the sample that you're
No, so actually what we do is we observe the whole graph. So for instance, you observe the whole graph. So given a graph, so I'll go slowly. So given a graph, this is the probability that you obtain that graph. So suppose you just have k equal to 2. So let's say t1 is the number of edges, t2 is the number of triangles. Given a graph, you evaluate this object here, and this is the probability under the model that you obtain that graph. Okay, so this is just a probability measure on the space of all graphs. Okay, so and these betas are the unknown parameters, and I'll later go into a more physics kind of problem where you are not trying to estimate, but you are just trying to understand this model for given.
So let me ask. I want to still ask a clarification. So I measure some graph,
yes.
And now my goal is to come up with some probability distributions over graphs, such that this graph would be sort of typical or most likely, whatever. If I do that in general, well, some probability distributions, there are too many distributions over all graphs.
Yes.
So instead, you say, okay, among the probability distributions over all graphs, which are of that form,
yes.
How should I choose the beta I such that it's most likely, or whatever you will tell us what your measure is, such that, so the single graph will tell you what probability should I have chosen to say it would have come.
Yes, as closely as possible. Yeah.
Just for further clarification, so what I think you're saying is this, so there are, you know, many graphs which have a given set of T1 through TK. Each of those occurs with a probability proportional to this.
Yes.
You then add, except leave out the psi of beta, you then add up all those numbers, and to make it come out to probability one, you divide in the end by that number so that each graph's likelihood of occurrence is proportional just to this number associated with the information T1 through TK.
Yes, so just since there is so much confusion, let me write this out completely clearly. Okay, so what you have is for any graph, so for any fixed graph, I'll write it with small letter. So random graph is capital letter, fixed graph is a small letter. Okay, And for any graph, you have these things, T1, G, T2, G, up to TK of G. Okay, so for any fixed graph, you can evaluate number of edges, number of triangles, and so on. Your probability measure is the following. Probability that your random graph is equal to a non-random graph is equal to e power summation beta I Ti of G minus psi beta. Well, this is such that this is actually a probability measure.
No, you postulate that.
Yes, that's a postulate.
And you don't know what the betas are.
No, I don't know what the betas are. I just observed this graph, and I want to know what the betas are. And in the, or, but you can just not consider the statistical problem at all. You can say, okay, I know the betas. What are the properties of this probability measure? So it was suggested that you take these triangles, and then the graphs will have certain clustering properties and so on. So this is a class of probability measures, or physical models, if you will. Okay. Yes.
Just a very quick comment to maybe take out a little bit of the apparent arbitrariness. The maximum entropy of P, subject to the constraint that the observables take on a certain value, that's realized by this exponential distribution. And that's one way of motivating this choice.
Yes, so from the physical point, and then we have the statistical side.
Sure.
So it depends on where your motivation comes from. Yes, but this is a very classical way of doing modeling statistical modeling data. So exponential families is an area of statistics. So let me move on from the first slide. So this was, the study was initiated in the random graph context of vaguely a little by Blesak, and then this was a more substantial paper, Holland and Leinhardt, and then there was some theoretical investigation at varying levels of rigor by Frank and Strauss, and then recently there have been very applied works by Snyders, so this is a survey, and requires a lot of computing power because these normalizing constants are not easy to obtain. Now in physics, so this I just got to know yesterday, in physics there has been, solutions to some models, and also forgot to write this, so I was in a hurry yesterday. Johannes and a co-author has this paper also by, so there have been some very recent investigation into these kinds of models. Yes?
There's also a huge literature in the social sciences that could exactly work.
Pardon?
There's a huge literature in the social sciences that work exactly with these exponential.
Yes.
Yes,
so this is in the survey of Snyder's.
By the University of Washington.
Yeah, Mark Hancock.
Yes, so people have been working, and what I'm hoping is that I'll show you some new things. The first part is the joint work with Joe Bilstein and Percy Diaconis. So you have this n parameter exponential family with n vertex degrees as a sufficient statistic. So you consider one parameter for each node. Okay, so you want to understand the degree sequence. So you have one parameter for each vertex, and you consider this model where you have this. So this minus came in because Percy wanted to put a minus. He wanted to be a physicist, but well, they can't take care to put another minus to take away this minus, but anyhow.
Physicists don't have a minus.
Yes, they don't, so that's what Percy forgot. Let's put a minus.
So when you say it's partial work with Percy, whenever you don't put the minus,
No. So this is just the first part. So there is a second part, which is mathematically more exciting. So you just have this model where you have a linear combination of the degrees, and you have normalizing constant, and you want to estimate these parameters just from a single realization. So the normalizing constant, it's easy to show that it's an explicit. So the sine of beta is an explicit normalizing constant, and there is literature on this thing. So people have looked at this thing, this object. Now, to see that this is a normalizing constant, you just, this graph is very easy to obtain actually. So you just put an edge between I and j with this probability, and then the joint density is just this. And so you get the normalizing constant. This is a very simple model. It's independent, joining edges independently. Now, the first interesting thing is that what is the range of expected degree sequences? Beta varies over Ra. Okay, so you take all possible values of these parameters, and what are all the expected degree sequences that you get? Okay. So here is the answer. Let D be the set of all possible degree sequences of graphs on n vertices, and the mean space, the space of all expected degree sequences, is exactly equal to the interior of the convex hull of this. So this is the Erdős-Galay polytope. And this is the largest possible mean space. So you take any probability distribution on graphs on n vertices, the expected degree sequence must lie over here in the convex hull. And what this says is that for any point in the convex hull, you can find the beta 1 to beta n so that you get that expected degree sequence.
So when you said this is the Erdős and so on, was this the theorem or the statement? Or the proof?
No, so this D is determined by this Erdős-Galay criterion.
But they didn't know that this is.
No. So this they never considered this model. But but you can show that this happens. So yes. So this is classical. So it does follow from classical results in exponential families and. So we found that out later, so we had a cute proof, but then we have to give that up because it exists. And you can see that this map which takes the betas to the expected degree sequence is a 1-1 onto a bijection between Rn and the Erdős-Galay polytope. So that's essentially what it is. So it cannot go outside. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it's exactly mm-hmm. this map. Now, so this is the first interesting thing. The next thing how to estimate this beta. So suppose you observe a graph. How do you recover the betas from there? So the standard thing in statistics is to do a maximum likelihood estimate. What you do is you write down the probability distribution and find the betas which maximizes the probability or the likelihood. And these are the set of n equations that you get. So you have n parameters. And you get any questions where di's are the degrees of the graph. Okay, but this doesn't look very friendly, that you have n equations and you have to solve it. However, what it turns out is that the system of equations can have at most one root. So this cannot have, so although there are n equations and unknowns, it can have at most one solution. There may not exist a solution. So the reason is very simple. The reason is that when you write down the probability as a function of betas, it's a log concave function. And so it can have at most one extremum. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, usually a solution exists. So this is but it may not. Okay. So there is you can construct very simple counterexamples. The reason is that the solution to these likelihood equations exists if and only if the observed degree sequence lies in the interior instead of on the surface of the polytope. Okay. So it's not very likely, you can show that it's not very likely that the solution will not exist. So these are the likelihood equations, and you know that they will exist at most one solution. Now, how to find the solution? So you have the graph, and how do you compute the solution? Is there an algorithm which gives numerically stable solutions or procedures or answers or whatever? So that was the first question, and this is, So there are Monte Carlo algorithms for maximizing the likelihood, finding the normalizing constant in an approximate sense. But there are n equations, and it's a huge space. And so the stability of these algorithms is somewhat questionable, what you can have from these things. So the thing is, a fast and stable algorithm actually exists. So start with this, you start with an initial estimate, and use this iteration, this particular iteration. So for each I, you iterate beta hat I n plus 1 as, so I shouldn't have written n because n already exists, so let's imagine this as k plus 1. So this is an iteration step. So you start with a vector, initial vector, and then you iterate. And you can show that this converges to the MLE geometrically fast. So, and it does actually, when you do it on the computer, it does converge very fast. And the reason is that if you iterate this map twice, it gives an L-infinity contraction map. So this is a way of converting your maximum likelihood equations into fixed point equations. You can do it in various ways. Most of them don't give fixed point contraction maps, but this
how
one does.
How small is your contraction constant at that map?
Oh, it depends on beta. So it's a locally a contraction map. So that's why the MLE may not exist. If it was a contraction map, MLE would have existed every time, right? So it's a locally a contraction map. So if an MLE exists, if there is a fixed point, then it will attract it towards that. But it may not exist. And the contraction constant will depend on the position where you are. And yeah. So that's the thing. So that's why the MLE may or may not exist. Now, okay, that's all very fine. So you have this model.
So could it be that there are starting points from which it takes really long?
In practice, it usually doesn't. So we have tried simulations and so on. Yeah,
it should be usually it should be exponential.
Pardon?
Usually exponential, I would think.
Actually, it takes order of n iterations if you have an n dimensional beta 1 to beta n. So if you have beta 1 to beta 100, it takes.
But for fixed number of betas.
Yes. Yeah. So yes.
How did you get this equation?
So I just converted the maximum likelihood equation to a fixed point equation. And for a suitable choice of the fixed point equation, so this is the suitable choice. So you get that. So if you take two iterations, so you do not get a contraction in one step because of certain reasons. So you get two iterations and it's an infinity contraction. Yeah.
So you can just use some Newton method to get this fixed point.
The Newton method, well, you have n parameters. You have an n by n Hessian matrix, so you have to invert that n by n matrix, which is not a. So it causes problems in practice if n is very large. So it causes a lot of problems actually. So this is a big issue. How to avoid that? So numerical problems, not theoretical. Numerical problems. Okay. So now, how does it perform? Okay, so that's the main question. You have n parameters. You have n. You are trying to estimate all these n parameters simultaneously from a single realization of the graph. And here are some pictures. Okay. So you have beta. I suppose they generated 100 beta. I just generated from uniform minus 1 to 1. You may have taken them on a grid. And this is the estimates versus the real parameters that you get for 100. Okay. This is from some other distribution, the Gaussian distribution, if I generate. This is, again, the estimates versus the parameters. It gets better if n increases, actually. So if you take n equal to 300, and betas are generated, again, from some distribution, this is the estimates versus the true parameters that you get. OK, so this is. But it may not always work. In certain situations, if the betas get too large on one side, then you may get some fluctuation. So this is what we have been doing with this, and one question is whether you can prove something about the accuracy of these estimates. So that's again under investigation. And the point is that. That with any degree distribution, you can actually fit these betas to get that degree distribution from the realization of the graph. So okay. So this is the first part of the talk, which is, as I said, it's very much just work in progress, and it's in limbo because Percy is in France and then here. And,
can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Why do you assume that the distribution is of that form, is of the form of an exponential distribution? I mean, does that always lead to good results, or are there cases where?
No, not necessarily. So one reason is that, okay, so you have to assume something, so you have to have a class of parameters.
Sure, you have to, I mean, it seems like a very natural class, but I don't know any statistics, so I was just wondering why.
So as you saw, the edge distributions come as independent, so edges are put down independently, so there's a concentration.
Another natural one would be to write a Gaussian, right, where you sort of divide it as E of di minus expectation of di squared, something like that.
Yes, so that can be, yeah, but that is not, the normalizing constant is not the explicit in that case, and you wouldn't have such a simple algorithm for doing that. So this gives, okay, so the point is not the sophistication, the point is the simplicity of the algorithm that you have. So you just have a very simple model, you can get all possible degree distributions from that, it covers all possible degree distributions, you can take any graph, very fast you can compute all the betas.
Okay.
So it's not the mathematical sophistication, but, So this is the first, part of the talk, and the second part is what is not joint work. So let me first make some remarks. It's that the simulation results suggest that the variance of beta hat I is smaller as beta I goes down in this model, and then dense graphs give better estimates. And the more remarkable fact is that the estimates seem to get better as n increases, so even though there are n estimates overall.
So what if I wanted the configuration model, if I wanted uniformly from all graphs this fixed degree sequence?
Okay, so what this does is chooses so for given beta 1 to beta n, you get expected degrees, but the degrees are also concentrated, okay? So what this does is that instead of getting it from fixed degree sequence, it takes like a fuzzy kind of thing nearby a fixed degree sequence and chooses uniformly from it.
So how fuzzy is it?
It's essentially, if the degrees are of order d, then it's square root d. So you take d and then you can divide it by square root d, and it gives uniformly from that. So you can even count the number of such graphs using these large deviations for degree sequences. You can do that kind of thing. So let's go to the next part, which I pursue independently of that. Which is going beyond degrees. So if you just have, instead of degrees, you have triangles. So I put this n to make these two comparable. So the number of triangles by n is comparable to the number of edges. And this is a normalizing constant, log of the normalizing constant. Okay. So the thing is, at least according to David Aldous, whom I asked, there is no rigorous work in this kind of thing. So he said you can find a lot of work with degrees, and of course lots of them are very deep and fantastic works, but as soon as you go into triangles, well, you have these tail bounds, upper tail bounds, very famous tail bound problem for triangles in reduction graphs and all that, but solutions of models like this, just yesterday I got to know from Mark Newman that he has these recent papers where they have the physical solutions. So in the physics methods, they have solutions. Now, the point is that if beta is equal to zero, then you have the Edo-Schein graph. But if beta is not equal to zero, then it's rigorously not known. So here is a solution. So this I'm just going to present quickly, and then I'll turn into the proof. Well, the thing is, the physics solutions, as usual, say that these flux of things are all concentrated, which, again, as Jennifer said the other day, problem is to get the concentration. And here, in this case, you don't have any independent random variables, so it's not clear how you can get the concentration. So define a function g. So to consider this function gx equal to this. So here is a theorem. So if either h is non-negative or beta is less than a constant, which I think can be improved to 4, so there is a unique p star, which is a fixed point of this g in 0, 1. And the limit of the normalizing constant divided by n squared is equal to this. Okay. So this is one typical result. So the method that I'm going to show doesn't only apply to this, it's quite generally can, instead of triangles, you can consider much more complicated objects. But this is just a sample result from that where you can obtain this kind of thing. And in fact, the theorem is true wherever this equation has a unique solution, is A1, and this is one particular region where you have that, but it's bigger than this. So here is the solutions, and there is a remark also in the paper of Johannesburg. So there are physical solutions, but this is rigorous. So this part, this theorem is rigorous.
This is an old problem in the physics community. Harris worked on this in the late 70s. In connection with problems with polymerization, mm-hmm. and I believe they had also the space transition long time ago.
I see. Yeah. So of course, the purpose of giving the talk is with the expectation that people will come and say, okay, we know this, we know how to do this, and so on. So,
did Harris do this rigorously?
As rigorously as he could. But it wasn't. It's not that far. It's not that far.
So let me sketch the method by. So this is a very general technique that I'm going to present now, and it's partly developed in my thesis, and the sketch is as follows. So let Xij be 1 if ij is an edge and 0 otherwise. Let Lij be the average number of cusps at I and j. So you take these two points I and j and you count the number of things like this. Okay. And then you take divide by n. So that's a number between 0 and 1. So this is the average number of cusps at I and j. The main step is the temperature free result. So this is the thing that I developed in my thesis, that how to obtain equations which hold approximately for all beta and h. So you see, let phi x be this function, e power beta x plus h over 1 plus e power beta x plus h. Then you can show with high probability that this Lij is approximately equal to 1 over n phi of Lik, phi of Ljk for all i's. So note that this high probability is outside. So I'm saying that all these equations hold together with high probability, irrespective of beta and h. So this is a new thing, okay?
But that is, irrespective of beta h, is not inside with high probability.
No, beta and h are fixed parameters, okay?
And approximate means plus little o of.
Yeah,
one.
So you can give tail bound, so you can give probability of this bigger than, so little o of 1 over square root n. Big O of 1 over square root.
So in the last case, you said that there was a phase transition.
There is a phase transition. Even though there is a phase transition, this continues to hold for all beta and h.
Okay.
But that is the main thing. So I'll give an example, a very simple example, where I'll show how to do this. So this is a method of obtaining temperature-free results, which holds for all beta and h. Okay. So I didn't want to disappoint you. So this is okay. So you can use similar techniques to show the number of edges. So again, these are other equations that hold approximately equal to phi of L. So these are all random variables. So these are sort of two random variables in the low temperature phase. And this equality, approximate equality between random variables continues to hold for all beta and h. Okay, so that's the goal to show this, irrespective of phase transitions. And in my thesis, I have things for extending to spin glasses also, where you can show in the Schoenstern-Crepp vacuum model things, certain equations hold for all beta and h, but you couldn't get anything out of those. So in the high temperature phase, what happens is that this system of equations, that these Lijs, they satisfy a certain system of equations. These system of equations have a unique solution, okay? And they're all approximately equal to the same constant. So you can conclude, for certain values of beta and h, these equations have a unique solution, and thereby you can conclude using monotonicity arguments or contraction arguments. So this h bigger than or equal to 0 induces monotonicity arguments, and this is for contraction arguments. You can show that with high probability, these Lij's are all equal to a constant. So I get the high temperature phase from these equations. I first get the equations. I show that they hold for all big Lij. Then I show that, these equations are unique solution in certain regimes, and these Lij's are all constants. So now the Hamiltonian is this. So you can easily see that the Hamiltonian is just this. This is the number of triangles. This is the number of edges. So you can somehow replace these Lij's by the constants, and you get Hamiltonian with independent, while the Xij's are independent. So that's the idea. So now the resulting model, if you replace these by constants, the resulting model is quite different in the sense of total variation distance, for instance. The resulting probability distribution that you get is quite different. But certain characteristics are approximately the same, like the normalizing constant is approximately the same. Correlations are same, central limit terms are same, so you can do that. You can replace the Lij's by constants. Okay? So this is the idea. Now the proof of a temperature-free result like this. So this is a temperature-free result, and how you prove these things. So I'll show you the basic general theorem, which is very simple. Then I'll go into an example, which is again very simple. So I'll not do this example. I'll go into a much simpler example, which I will actually present in the talk. Okay. So here's the thing. So this is, Stein's method is for normal approximation, but Percy gave me this problem for my thesis, or suggested that Stein tried to do concentration, and he couldn't, so that this would be a good problem to try to do concentration equal to using Stein's method. So suppose xx prime is an exchangeable pair of random variables. By that I mean xx prime, the pair has the same distribution as x prime x. Okay. So the pair xx prime has the same distribution as x prime x. So okay, so this slide and the next are very abstract, but then the third one is a real example. So suppose you have a function which is anti-symmetric. F of xx prime is identically equal to minus f of x prime x. And the conditional expected value of f xx prime given x is little f of x. Okay. Then you can show it using the anti-symmetry, then the expected value of little f of x is 0. Moreover, for any g by this line, you have this equality. Okay, so this is equal to this. Exchangeability implies that here you can interchange x and x prime. So this gives, from the exchangeability, you get this. And from the anti-symmetry, you can again interchange xx prime inside this, and you get a minus outside. So you get this thing. So you get that this is equal to this, and this is again equal to this. So you can take the average of these two things, and you get this. So Elkanah told me that this is a well-known trick when dealing with this influence of variables when you have functions of independent random variables, but this is somewhat more general where you need not have independent random variables. You just have two random variables or vectors. So this x is typically a random vector, which is exchangeable. Okay, so this is the first equation. Taking g equal to f, we get a formula for the variance. And taking g equal to e power theta fx, one can get sub Gaussian tail bounds. So you can get tail bounds for fx. Okay. So this is again slightly tricky, but you can get that. So now let's go into an example how this applies to give these temperature-free results. So just consider the very simple model, the Curie-Weiss model, where you have the Gibbs measure on n spins, which is the normalizing constant times e power beta over n, sum of sigma I sigma j, where sum over all I and j. So this is the simplest model of ferromagnetic interaction, or Dising model on a complete graph. And the magnetization of this model is defined to be this, the average of the spins. Okay. So here is how you construct an exchangeable pair. Given a sigma, choose a coordinate I uniformly and replace the ith coordinate by a value chosen from the conditional distribution given the other coordinate. So that's just taking one step in the Gibbs sampler. So this is just taking one step in the Gibbs sampling algorithm, or by whatever other name we know it. So you just choose a coordinate I at random, replace the ith coordinate by the condition, by something chosen condition given the other spins. So if sigma prime is the resulting state, then this is an exchangeable pair. Sigma prime is an exchangeable pair which differs only in one coordinate. Okay. So let this capital F, this anti-symmetric function of sigma and sigma prime, the difference of sigma and sigma prime at the ith coordinate, where I was the coordinate where it was changed. So what you get if you do the computation is that little f of sigma, which is the conditional expectation of this thing given sigma, is m minus this thing, tan h of beta mi, where mi is almost the magnetization. It's the magnetization with one spin removed. Okay. So you just get this. So then, now it's very easy to check that this is bounded by 2. So this is just bounded by 2, no problem. And the difference, so if you perturb f at one coordinate, it perturbs at most by order of 1 over n. Okay. So thus, what the theorem says, the very simple lemma that I showed, says that this holds. And you also know that mi deviates from m by at most 1 over n. So combining this, what you get is that m minus tan h of beta n squared, this is irrespective of beta, you get this bound. 2 times 1 plus beta over n plus beta squared over n squared. So this shows, this is a well-known result that the magnetization satisfies mm-hmm. m approximately tan h of beta, irrespective of beta, whether it's in the high temperature phase or in the low temperature phase. And this has multiple roots for beta bigger than 1. But this bound that you get has no problem with all that. So you just get a simple bound. And similarly, you get a very simple tail bound also with very simple exponents, Gaussian tail bound. So the tail bounds are actually essential. To have simultaneously all those n squared equations holding simultaneously, you need Gaussian tail bounds. Okay. So this is the trick, and this is what I use. Since I have time, let me just go back to the technique once again. So you start with an exchangeable pair of random variables. So typically, what you have is your whole graph, and then you perturb it at one coordinate. So you just change at one coordinate by choosing uniformly, choosing conditionally given the rest. Okay. Then you start with an anti-symmetric function, and you have this expected value of fxx prime given x is little f of x. And then by this argument over here, this using the exchangeability and anti-symmetry, you show that this holds, and from this you get a formula for covariance. So this, in a very abstract sense, this is integration by parts. So this is just what you have is what the analysts do. As I didn't know that at the time of my thesis, but this is in the continuous setting. This is what they do with Dirichlet forms. So and then the good thing is that you can get sub-Gaussian tail bounds also from this. And here is the example. So you just want to know something about the magnetization. You don't even have to do any analysis. You just start with the magnetization in the Q-device model. You just choose this very simple function. You just choose this very simple function where you just the difference between the coordinates where it changed. And if you take the conditional expectation, what you get is approximately m minus tan h of beta m. Okay. And then just these two very trivial bounds give a bound on the variance. Give this L2 bound, and similarly gives tail bound. So this is exactly the method by which I obtained the thing for the Lijs. So coming back to the triangles, these Lijs, this model where this was a number of cusps at the ij step, you show this thing by appropriately defining the anti-symmetric function, and the chain is a dip sampler. So well, it's somewhat more complicated, not the Gibbs sampler. So you have to change two edges at I and J. And then that gives you this thing with tail bound, so you can show that in hyperbolic all these equations hold simultaneously. Okay, so one example, the original reason why I started studying this triangles thing, it was not arbitrary. It was because, Demo gave me this problem about large deviations for triangles in random graphs, actually computing large deviation rate functions for triangles in regression graphs instead of getting concentration bounds. And Francis Comets and Amir has been trying to prove this for the last, or to obtain the rate function, they have this conjecture for the last 5 years. So I thought, okay, that might be a good problem. So this is what you can get. So let IRS be this very familiar function for any RS in 0, 1. So you can show the following. Let Tn be the number of triangles in GnP, where P is bigger than or equal to half. Then for any R, you can show that the probability Tn bigger than n cubed r cubed over 6 is equal to this. Okay. If P is less than half, the same result holds for all R bigger than P but up to something. It cannot go all the way up to 1. Okay. So this result holds, so this is a high temperature phase. And there should be a phase transition, but I have not been able to obtain the rate functions. This is the rate function for the triangles in a random graph in certain phases. So P bigger than or equal to half corresponds to a region H bigger than or equal to 0 in the Hamiltonian that you have, right, the triangle's Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is a direct consequence of that. Okay,
this looks like one of these things. The combinatorial is to calculate numbers with generating functions and stuff. That sort of sticks out of the ears and noses. So that is something I didn't know.
Like no. Boris Patel and those guys all the generating function calculations. You couldn't get this with generating.
So Boris or Bela didn't know.
So Amir told me as recently as few months ago that they don't.
Okay, I mean, I don't know. I wonder if they're not able to get this, what they're doing.
No, the thing is, you see, there is a complication here. The complication is that, okay, this looks very simple. First of all, there's R cubed. So actually, if you put T, you get the cube root of R. But that's not a big deal. The thing is, it doesn't hold for all R and P. So any argument that gives it cannot
be a subtle argument.
Yes,
yeah.
So it cannot. It doesn't hold for all R and P.
Uh-huh.
So there cannot be a simple.
So the generating function presumably wouldn't be seeing a difference there.
Probably not. Amir and Francis Comets have been done actually is not for triangles but for like things which do not close up on them.
Uh-huh.
They have done it and they have a conjecture and this matches the conjecture. So they just by analogy they have the conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
And they have used all kinds of things in the paper. So.
Mm-hmm.
So they said they ran.
Yeah.
So there will be a phase transition in here in the rate function.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what you can get as an application of the triangles thing. Now, the remarks that the technique is quite general. You can replace. It's very easy to replace triangles by much more complicated objects. It's just the same analysis. We just have to obtain those temperature free equations that hold for. So these, of course, I should say they're inspired by the mean field equations, but the difference is that in the physics, mean field equations usually have unconditional averages. So you take expected values of x, I, j, and then you get equations, but here you have random variables and you get equations. And the low temperature phase is still intractable, but these equations still continue to hold. So that we have some information. And provided the equations do not have too many solutions, I can solve the low temperature phase. But I cannot prove that the equations will not have too many solutions, okay, or too many relevant solutions. So that is where I'm stuck, and I'll be very happy.
Can you do the high temperature phase of the spin glass?
For which spin glass?
Just a sort of standard Kirby spin. I mean, this spin glass analog of the Kirby
SK.
SK model with JIJ, and then you normalize with n squared instead
of
1 over n.
Yeah, well, yes, the SK
or squared of n, excuse me.
SK model, so the SK model is a lot more complicated. So of course, Talleyrand has his proof in the subset of the high temperature phase,
right.
And I have different proof of that, so.
So
it's,
that's my question. So it gives a similar proof of the.
This
of
doesn't
the
give, as
challenge.
I said, so the things are not concentrated. So this is. Well, I'm giving this talk at UDAP next Monday, where I show that the corresponding LIJs that you obtain in that case have actually a distribution which is a mixture of two Gaussian densities. And that's why you can move the tan h inside. So you have the expected value of the tan h of a random variable. And what the phases do is that they move the tan h inside. But in spin glasses, you do not only move it inside, but you get some correction term. So this happens if x is a mixture of two Gaussians. That's my different argument, that if x is a mixture of two Gaussians, you can actually move the expected value inside, and you get a correction term, which is exactly the one-second correction term. And you get the Thule-Sanderson boundary equations. So you get those equations. So you can solve the SK model in the subset of the high temperature phase, not going after the whole of the 89.
So do you have that on your webpage?
No, nothing is on my webpage. It's all working. But I've shown the proof to Caligan. He says it's correct and he says it doesn't matter.
He says it's correct and he doesn't understand.
So this is, yes, just advertising my talk on Monday. So this is all I have. This is.